Hello, everyone listening at home. Welcome to the Highlander Cast. We are the official podcast of the 7-point Highlander format. I am your first host, Sarv, and Vance is not with us this week, but we have a very special guest star from Adelaide Eternal. We have Beckett Wolf.
G'day.
So, Beckett, maybe before we jump into our weekly discussion, you can just give the audience a super brief summary of who you are, what you do in Magic, what you like to play, that kind of stuff.
Oh, well, yeah, my name's Beckett. I'm part of the Adelaide Eternal team, founded by Sarv and myself and Socrates Stavropoulos, and now including Drew Cutter, of course. And yeah, I mean, I've just always loved Eternal formats, and Highlander's the exact perfect format where you can play all your cards. It's competitive. I just loved it. I've always loved it. Really happy to be part of its history.
Alrighty, thanks for that intro, Beckett. So what we're going to do is we're going to be talking a little bit about what the big changes to the format are after this recent points announcement in tandem with the Coldheim cards as well. And rather than kind of going over what we did in the previous episode, which was actually review lots of individual powerful cards, we'll talk more in terms of the metagame as a whole. And before we leap into it, we do have a regular segment called What's the Point? And that's one where we basically just pick a pointed card and we chat about it and really why it is that, you know, whatever status it is on the list. So for this particular week, we've actually done Lutri the Spell Chaser in the past, but I'd actually like to revisit this as a What's the Point, specifically because we've got you on the episode, Beckett. Now, for those who don't know, you've been championing Lutri for a long time now. At one point, even after the points, mechanic change, whereby you now pay 3 mana as at sorcery speed to put the companion in your hand, you still rate this as one of the, if not maybe the, best 1-point blue cards that you can put into a control deck or a variety
Absolutely.
Of different decks.
Yeah. Or red deck. Look at Mulch, who won with Goblins recently, and he had Lutri in his sideboard.
Yeah, so true, so true. So there's some, you know, obvious aspects around the, well, if it's 0 points, then sure, it will be an easy free roll in many, if not every Highlander deck, just as this kind of bonus late game thing you can do with your spare mana flood, basically drawing a card. But what are some other perspectives that you have on the card and why you rate it so highly?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it has to be at least 1 point because, as you say, otherwise it's a free roll. But is it worth 1 point in your deck? Because that's a cost. And I think absolutely. The way I view Lutri and I guess points in general is I see a massive difference between something like a Snapcaster Mage, which everyone knows is like a powerful card, but it's still costing you a slot in your deck as well. And that's a big difference. So what's the difference in power level between Snapcaster Mage and Direfleet Daredevil? I think it's a reasonable difference, and it's probably worth 1 point, but there's absolutely nothing to compare Lutri to. It doesn't cost anything out of your deck. So really, if we're going to add Lutri to our sideboard, we've got to say, well, yes, it's costing us a point, but we still get the Direfleet Daredevil. It just means we play Direfleet Daredevil or Seagate Stormcaller or something instead of Snap, and that's not a massive difference. But, you know, the difference between Seagate and Snap, it's noticeable, but it's not substantial. And so, you know, that's how I like to look at it. It's a free point. And I see the same with something like a Caracas where, well, I'm just replacing a Plains or another untapped white source and I get this amazing ability that can potentially win me the game. It doesn't cost anything to my deck. And that's where I think the real power of Lutri comes in. And I hardly ever side it in. Whenever I'm, well, not side it in, but bring it in. Whenever I'm playing, I don't go, oh, I've got, you know, do I keep up my mana leak or do I put Lutri into my hand? I can't decide. I keep up mana leak. I pretend it's not there until I'm completely out of gas or I just happen to have 3 mana extra up or I've got like a Force of Will effect in my hand. And at that point, I bring it in. And you know what? 50% of the games, you know, don't even go like that late. And then another maybe 30% of the games, the Lutri won't make a difference because either you've got surplus gas or it wasn't enough gas. But the fact that there can be 20% of the time when you're, I mean, I'm just making these stats up, of course, but the fact that there can be like 20% of the time where it feels like 20%, where you get this lutri into your hand, you do a ponder, lutri ponder, or something busted like swords, lutri swords, or acol, lutri acol, and it gets you back in this game that you would have otherwise lost. And it, again, it doesn't cost anything to your deck. It just feels completely busted.
Yeah, that's such a good analysis. When you look at what you're losing versus what you're gaining, this is something that you often talk about when we're doing our team meetings and, you know, chatting about points decisions, where, you know, what would this card otherwise be? And you go, okay, well, this would otherwise be a basic planes, and I will put 1 point and turn that into a powerhouse card like Caracas, as opposed to the cost of, you know, a specific slot within your deck. Like you were saying, Snapcaster Mage. Okay, you can play a plethora of playable cards in that slot, but there's a difference between a playable free card in your sideboard, which cannot be replaced by anything other than, say, Yorion, you know, or, you know, Lurrus. These have major costs to your deck.
Mm.
this no cost.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's why I've been playing Acol for so long. Maybe not now that there's 5 points. We'll get into that later, I'm sure. But I've been playing Acol for so long because the difference between Acol and what would replace it, I don't know, a sleight of hand, is just phenomenal. It's way bigger than the difference between a Seagate Stormcaller. Is that the right card? The one that Seagate Stormcaller and Snap. You know, there is a difference there, but it's nothing close to Acol and sleight of hand. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the difference between my points. Because I think there's a cost to your points list, but there's also a cost to your deck as a whole. And Lutri has nothing to compare it to other than a sideboard slot. So it's a very, very minimal cost to your deck.
Summed it up really well. So I guess it's safe to say that, you know, going on from what's the point to the topic of this episode, you're probably going to be continuing to play Lutri in the metagame, you know, with or without Ancestral Recall. You've just given us such great examples of cards that are just absolute game swings, absolute blowouts, where, you know, swords, Lutri swords can just control the game dramatically. So let's talk about the topic of today. So the topic is really just an opportunity for Beckett and myself to essentially banter about the nature of the metagame, how it has shifted and how it will shift, or what we foresee as some of the shifts based on these recent points changes and recent printings. So perhaps we should get the big question, the massive change out of the way as a good discussion point first. So off the chopping block, we're gonna talk about the two pieces of blue power. So Time Walk at 5, Ancestral Recall at 5. This is an unprecedented move. You can go and have a look at any of the other content, like the points announcement document or Jimbo and Vance's live stream where they talked about the points changes. This is, you know, something very, very new, having 5-point cards in Highlander.
Well, who made this rule that you can't? Where did that come from?
this seems to be just a mainstay of the format for the last X number of years, decades even. It's just been this kind of rule that the highest point is 4, you know? It's an unspoken rule. It's never been written down.
No, exactly. Everyone was like, oh, you can't do that. And I'm like, why? Yeah. Why not?
Can't do that. Oh, it means that we have to change the website and adjust some lists, because it's only 4. 4's the there's 4 columns.
Whoever's doing the website, they've got the motive.
When we talk about this in the context of big changes, it's not just a, you know, big change to the points list. It's really a big change to the way that we build Highlander decks. So if I could field perhaps the first, you know, the baseline interpretation is, when you're a deck builder now and you're brewing in the format, if you're new to the format or you're enfranchised, when you look at that points list, what those two pieces of power at 5 are saying is, if you want to spend the majority of your points on one of these cards, you must build around it to make it the maximum possible value, which means that hopefully we'll see less Acol in this tempo deck, control deck, mid-range deck, you know, just so many different points at which aggro, you know, Fringy Bros, Jeskai aggro deck is playing Ancestral Recall. With this perspective, maybe it's the point that people are going to shift back to more, if I'm going to play Highlander and I want to have, you know, fair interactive magic, I'm probably more likely going to spread my points out. If I pay 5 points for one of these cards, I'm probably going to build around it to make it degenerate. I want to take a whole bunch of loops with Time Walk, or I want to draw 9 to 12 cards a game.
I couldn't agree more, especially your Time Walk example. Like, the only deck that I would want to run Time Walk in now is a something that loops it with, you know, the Ephemerate Eternal Witness deck, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we were seeing before, we saw Time Walk creep up. I remember that Time Walk had spotty play in pre-2017.
And it was at 3 points.
It was at 3 points. It saw, you know, occasional play here and there. And then obviously people kind of realized that it was powerful, like truly, truly busted when you put it into, you know, really, really aggressive shells like Rug Life, where you're playing both pieces of blue power for 4 and 3 points. Maybe this is busted. And then I started noticing, okay, maybe it's just correct to throw a 3 point Time Walk into any mid range deck. And I played like Grixis Control, and then I put Time Walk in it, and I'm like, hang on, this is actually really good. So then I made Grixis mid range, and just I realized that Time Walk just slotted instantly into every mid range blue deck because you were applying pressure to the board. It didn't have to be a tempo deck. If you're committing to the board, then having 3 points where you just randomly draw it and you go, well, now I win the game, is probably pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I think I was started losing to Time Walk was against tempo, and it just felt really Buster-oonskies when your opponent's resolved a Mentor or you know, a Delver, or even just something like a Young Pyromancer.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't get back from it sometimes, and it shows that it's gone up 2 points since back then, and as is Acol, and I think it's really good. You can't play either of them in the same. In the same deck, mm-hmm. Both of them in the same deck at the same time. Yeah, I don't know what the future holds. I think Acol probably does deserve to be 5 points, mm-hmm. And I think Time Walk probably does. Will it still see play though? I'm really not sure.
I think they'll both see, they'll see good levels of play in dedicated decks. You know, in the past, like we're saying, mid range deck just chucks in Time Walk at 4 points. You know, the cost benefits analysis, you kind of go, well, if I draw this, it's essentially game winning. And then there's ways to find it where your Birthing Pod turns any two drop into, you know, two Time Walks through Spellseeker is pretty scary. So now people are probably going to be playing that, you know, Birthing Pod, Time Walk. So that's 6 points. And then the seventh point ends up being, you know, some other flex slot, Ren and Six, or, you know, whatever other glue they want to use to stick the deck together. And that shell still exists and is still strong. So
it'll be like a Time Walk deck or an Acol deck, not, you know, a mid-range or a control or a tempo. Yeah. You'll be playing, oh, he's playing a Time Walk deck.
Exactly. And so the good thing is that the design space opens up pretty dramatically for decks that were forced to play Time Walk and Ancestral Recall, or mainly Ancestral Recall in the past. When you look at Control, you'll notice that historically Control has been, you know, a dig through time deck where you just kind of go, look, I want to have card quality. I want to end of turn cast a dig through time, get a counterspell and a threat, or, you know, to a Wrath effect and then a counterspell or whatever it is. I'm just going to get the two pieces that just shore up my victory and incrementally gain advantage. It's possible that if you noticed in some of the previous control decks, almost all the control decks were going, well, if I own an Ancestral Recall, it is just correct to play this Ancestral Recall rather than Treasure Cruise and Dig Through Time at 4 points total. No one really did that, Treasure Cruise and Dig Through Time together. But as a comparison, when you look at the two on face value, I could play this or this for 4 points. It's now at the point that I think people are going to be going back towards some of those pre-2017 deck building times where control plays dig through time, plays a whole slew of 1 point cards, and just has a really, really consistent game plan. What do you think?
Yeah, probably not for me. I've never liked dig through time. But obviously people are going to start going back to, I guess, the old school. What do they call it? The Melbourne points, you know?
Melbourne points, like, yeah, I remember
Jace,
that.
Jace, Snap, Mana Drain, whatever, and you just play a bunch of seven one-pointed blue spells.
Yeah, there's been a lot of taxes on that, including like True Name Nemesis at two and so on. Yeah, but there was a point there where the correct blue stew was pretty much solved. You know, these 7 points, if you're going to play a fair blue deck, this is what you're going to do. That's been changed up a bit with, you know, Dig and Cruise and True Name all being two, you know, deservingly so. But there's definitely probably going to be a point at which where we end up finding a stew of blue cards that hopefully does not include Ancestral Recall and is a really, really affordable, competitive pile.
Couldn't agree more. Are you going to be playing it yourself, Sarv?
So I've been looking at Ancestral Recall, and you know, the interesting thing is there's a lot of when you look at results and decks that people choose to play, there's a lot of, well, if I own it, I play it, or there's a lot of personality. If I like this, I play it, type of approaches to Highlander, and for me, Ancestral Recall has been a lot of that. I've played Ancestral Recall, you know, religiously for about the last 3 years, and just, you know, couldn't tear me off it because I'm like, well, I now own this card because I own it. I will make sure I play it.
That's how I started using it. I started playing it in Kespile just because I was like, I own it, I want to play it. And mm-hmm. then years later, it really, really seemed to be correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. As the blue points started to go up, it went, okay, well, this thing is now underpointed. So yeah, I think that there will be times where I will definitely sleeve Ancestral Recall up again. But those will be ones where I'm going to be playing Ancestral Recall, Spellseeker, and Merchant Scroll. So I'm going to be having my 6 points as those, and then my seventh point will pretty much always be Mystic Sanctuary, because then with Gush and Daze, I'm going to be looping that Ancestral Recall continuously. So that's probably going to be my points if I play Ancestral Recall. The good thing now is, when I choose not to sleeve up my ridiculously expensive card that I'm always like, I should probably sell this and pay some house bills, I can go, well, okay, I'll come back to that another time when I want to, you know, build with this. But there's other things I can do in the format. I can spend my 5 points elsewhere and not feel bad about playing something that feels weaker than Ancestral Recall.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the beauty of this pointing is that, I mean, Acol's still playable, you can still play it, but it just encourages you to spread out and try something else. Because I was the same, I was like, I really can't justify not playing Acol and, an Oko. And I don't really love Oko as a card. I mean, I played in Vintage, but, you know, it doesn't inspire me. But I was like, it's like, I better just play it. So now I'm really excited, to be honest, just to try something new.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, That's a really good segue into Oko. So Oko's obviously gone up to 2 points now, and that's a really, you know, direct comparison to something like True Name Nemesis, where if you were going, I have 2 points to spend, will I spend them on a True Name Nemesis in my deck? Or will I spend it on one Oko and one other powerful card, like a Mana Drain or a Force of Will or, you know, whatever the one other point powerful point is. Now with them both being at 2 points, I assume Oko will see about as much play as True Name Nemesis sees, which is a not irrelevant and certainly good level of play that often wins games.
Yeah. I think whenever people see Oko at any, you know, in any format, at any pointing, they're still like, ugh, like that's an issue. Like, do I have the board to kill this? Like, probably not. And it can make this degenerate games the same way True Name does, you know, if you don't have the trophy or the abrupt decay for it. And yeah, I think it'll still see play. I think it's still definitely worth 2 points. But I think, my deck's a perfect example. I don't really love Oko, but I couldn't justify not playing it in a blue-green deck. So I just played it. But now that it's at 2 points, if I want to play blue-green, I feel like I can actually justify not playing it. And I can spread my wings into something that I would, you know, like my that reflects my personality better and is still competitive. So, yeah, I mean, obviously the big, and it was mentioned in the, when you guys did the points announcement, but, you know, obviously the alternative was to point something like Uro. And I think I was on the point Uro bandwagon. But this, like, essentially does the same thing, doesn't it? Like, pointing Oko and point plus one and pointing Uro is pretty similar. But obviously people can still play blue-green X and play Uro and save a few points there.
And likewise, if Oko's one, they can still play the same deck and keep their Oko at one and not play the Uro. And if anything, the thing that people are just the most unhappy about is seeing an Oko on the other side of the table. You know, when you go at turn one Lanowar Elves, turn two Oko, and you're in the play, what do you do?
Yeah, well, you just gotta have the abrupt decay or the trophy. Yeah, I mean, later in the game, like, Oko's not even that brutal early in the sense that it's so similar to True Name Nemesis, because there's definitely, like, you can just combo out against True Name Nemesis. You're like, I'm playing on a different axis, you know, stuff you. But if there's plenty of games where you're just like, oh, I'm like trying to play mid range or I'm trying to play control, and I'm just like never going to be able to beat that. I just don't have the tools. I don't have the tools to beat that. And that's what creates a degenerate game. And that's why it's so frustrating. But similarly, you got to say, Uro does the same thing for burn decks or aggro decks, which are less
prevalent. Yeah, it's punishing, isn't it?
Yeah, but Oko does it to mid-range decks. You're trying to go like, oh, I'm going to level up my Hex Drinker, now it's a 4-4, then I'll, you know, I'll play my whatever, my Tireless Tracker, and they're just like, another 3-3.
Enjoy your Elks.
And you're like, okay, I've got to go over, I've got to like beat the 3-3s, because they're just making Elks. So I've got to do something better than 3-3s. I'm going to play, you know, like this Questing Beast. And they're like, oh, no, Questing Beast are 3-3. You're like, all right, yeah, that's what that does.
I'll block, like, with okay, my food token.
And then they just swap, anything else you play that's like, you know, like your Deathrite Shaman that might be able to win on a different axis. Mm. Ah, it's just brutal. Such a good card.
Yeah, so true. Well, the good thing is, I think in terms of the metagame shifting, there will be a lot of things that stay the same and a lot of things that go differently. So the things that stay the same are, if you're playing a Time Walk Birthing Pod loops deck, then Oko going to 2 and Time Walk going to 5 means, well, you just cut Oko and you play exactly the same deck. Like, the deck can stay identical and you replace Oko with any other 3-drop finisher that you want to replace it with. And, you know, you can get that Ashiok Nightmare Weaver into your deck, or, you know, whatever else you wanted to do at three mana. Yeah, spicy. So it is obviously a downgrade. You know, those decks are going to see less Oko. But their deck still remains the same if they want to go down the path of, I want to loop this card. The good thing is that as a player, you're going to see fewer Okos, because there will be a cohort of people that go, cut the Oko so I can keep my deck the same. It won't be much of a loss. But there are a lot of games that people win with Oko alone. You know, regardless of what the rest of their deck was doing, if they were a combo deck and they had 6 points for their combo and they had a free point and they were just playing Oko, because randomly you sideboard against their combo and then they just go, well, I just land this Oko and you don't have any way to deal with it because you took out your abrupt decays and everything. Taking away that random free win element to the format and putting it in someone's deck when they go, I'm going to spend 2 of my 7 points on this card that will randomly get me free wins. You know, like Strip Mine. Randomly, I'm just going to win a game off this. Then that's a good thing from the format as a whole, because I assume that overall we're going to see a more interactive.
As well.
Yeah, exactly. They more interactive.
They're like, this person's devoted a significant portion to this pointing. Yeah,
that's it. There's a bit more back and forth. And when something is one-sided, you go, well, okay. It's like someone played the True Name Nemesis. And, you know, everyone's been there. With the True Name at 2, you just completely forget about it. You cut your, Liliana's version of the Diabolic Edict and so on. And then they just play the True Name and you go, oh, yeah, that card. I don't think I've got an answer for it. Now, We've talked about the cards that went up. Now let's talk about the cards that went down and how that might... Yeah, this is exciting. You know, this tells you kind of what, you know, the format is going to push towards, because we have, first and foremost, let's talk about the, you know, the most exciting one, the clearest, you know, front runner for the most exciting D point of late, which is Talarian Academy going to 1 point. Now, Talarian Academy is historically a busted card, right? It generates ridiculous amounts of mana and allows you to do crazy things. It's been 2 points. And the thing is, the card has been in the format forever, and it's been at 2 points for a significant portion of this time. And yet people don't play it much. You know, they definitely pops up here and there at 2 points. It has popped up in the occasional Time Vault deck or whatever it might be. But fundamentally, people are not sleeving it up. The moment it's gone to 1 point, you can see the frenzy. Even in the first week or so, there's been a couple of online events, webcam and online events. So I know you've been looking at the results of recently, so you might be able to comment on, where we just see Academy just popping up. And in not just, you know, one specific solved deck, but it's popping up in a variety of different ways to build Academy decks. And that's really exciting.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I still play Vintage, and Talarian Academy, strip mine in Vintage is like actually not that good because it's too slow. Because you essentially take a whole turn off just to strip them, and then there's no point if they're just going to unsap and go like, oh, well, like Mox Mana Crypts win, you know, win the game. Paradoxical outcome, win the game. But you've got to keep your strip mine in because of Talarian Academy, basically. It's just such a powerful card. I think it probably doesn't lend itself to Highlander that well. It's probably like a 2 to 3 point card, but it's so built around in Highlander, not in Vintage, but in Highlander, it's so built around that I think that makes it a restrictive cost. And so I think it being at one is really exciting. Of course, I think any deck that's going to run Talarian Academy is going to go pretty all in on against Nalrod, as in, you're just saying, I'm just going to pack it up if I play against Uvo and Nalrod. And I think that you can see, like, I think Isaac Egan was playing Candelabra in his list in the top eight of the Bluebell Cup number 2, season 2. And I think that's, like, the point where you're playing Candelabra is the point where you're all in. I'm not saying it's bad, but, like, imagine your opponent having collected Uvo out, and you're just like, how am I going to get out of this? What do I have, a Chain of Vapor in my deck or something? And then you top deck Candelabra, you're like, that's not going to do it. You know, it's so all in. But if there's any card that can do it, it's going to be a Talarian Academy. And it's so much fun, especially if you're playing blue. And because it doesn't generate colors mana. It generates blue mana. I mean, blah.
Card's yes. Great. Yes, so
and
true.
And with Tinker going down recently as well, Tinker's gone down a bit.
Tinker was three for a decent amount of time, right?
Yeah. Was Tinker four at any point?
This is where we need Vance. Vance will talk about the history of
it. I sound like an idiot, but I'm gonna tentatively say I think Tinker was 4 points at one point. Because I remember playing Tinker Sol Ring. It was my first ever Highlander deck, and that was my 7 points.
Nice. Yeah, that's I mean, it shows how times have changed that Tinker was at one point the best thing for you to do if it was, control deck with a combo finish, let's say, the best thing for you to do was Tinker into Blightsteel Colossus.
That's what I did. And I lost to Goblins because they had some black, and I was like, I've won, right? It was like a turn 3 Tinker Blightsteel. I was like, they're good at nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. And they had some Goblin that bounces your creature. What is that? In Black Red Goblins, I mean, I don't know, maybe it was in Japanese and my opponent lied to me. Maybe Mulch can tell me what the goblin is, but I couldn't believe there was a goblin that bounced it.
Yep. And so we're talking about how obviously times have changed, and you know, some of these plays aren't as absolutely degenerate as they used to be. But if you look at that, you know, one of the most recent points of data, as you're saying, is this the Bluebell Open. The results there, there's two Tinkers in the top eight.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty diverse, to be honest with you. But certainly, I mean, there's a Time Vault deck in there as well, which I haven't seen in a long time.
Yes.
So certainly there's a bit of a push to artifacts, which you would have otherwise not have seen.
Yeah, and that's so good to see, because when we just take that top eight as just an example, you can see that there's three Talarian Academies at one point in that top eight. So people have a lot of confidence, you know, a lot of faith in a card to choose to sleeve it up in a highly competitive, you know, finals type event. And one of them is a Talarian Academy deck with Time Vault as its win con. Another of the decks, and that one is, let's see, so that one's piloted by Aaron, and Aaron's been on Time Vault for a decent amount of time, like the last probably year or so of webcam events, constantly just winning with this pile of, you know, really low-costed turbo Time Vault approach cards, but then this kind of control-y almost package, and then, you know, a mentor finisher. It's really, really cool.
Traditionally the Time Vault decks were blue-black.
Yes. Because
I think they were based off Vintage, and the Vintage Time Vault, devoted Time Vault decks, mm-hmm. that is, were blue-black, you know, with Vamp Tutor and stuff like that. So it's really interesting to see someone go like a four-color Time Vault list. And yeah. He's obviously been playing it a while to get that good at it. I don't know how good it is. A pilot? That's the thing. You need more data, right? Because it could just, I don't know, Aaron, but it could just be that he's a really good pilot. And if you've been playing a deck for so long, you're going to get really proficient with it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's always one thing that it's hard to divorce in Highlander with a small pool of players. You know, you probably sum it up to about 200 or 300 players, you know, that are actively playing Highlander around the world. And yeah, someone can just keep, you know, refining an archetype to exactly their playstyle, exactly their personality, and know every intricate line and eke out, you know, massive amounts of win potential from it. And you go, well, this is the best deck. And then you sleeve it up and you just go, oh, I can't win with it. What's going on? And, you know, then it's the other end of the spectrum where the deck is just absolutely amazing, and no matter who's piloting it, it's going to be really strong. And it's hard to tell, you know, where decks lie. But yeah, it's really cool to see these diverse. So one of those decks, Talarian Academy decks, was a Time Vault deck. The other deck was piloted by Michael Leslie, and this one is a Tinker deck, and it's got that traditional Blightsteel Colossus there ready to finish, and then it just generates exorbitant amounts of mana to drop out things like Ulamog the Ceaseless Hunger, Kozilek the Great Distortion, and that's, you know, very, very much enabled by Talarian Academy. And then you switch over to Isaac's deck. So let's see, this one has Candelabra, like the previous one as well, but it's got Draw Sevens, Time Twister, Wheel of Fortune, Echo of Eons, and it has things like Tezzeret the Seeker in it, which is a massive, you know, throwback, you know, to what would that be, you know, 2012.
That's a throwback to the Vintage, the blue-black lists. They would play V-Click and Tez, because Tez finds Time Vault and ups Time Vault, so it's the combo by itself. But yeah, it's such old school tech, isn't it? Especially with so many Pyroblasts rolling around. Although there's less Pyroblasts than ever, with Michael Billinghurst winning on Esper Control. You know, us in Adelaide, we're on Bant, we don't have Pyroblasts, and yeah, maybe it's a really good time for Tez Seeker.
Yeah, I think so. So this is a great example of how a small change, very, very small change, it, you know, what it looks like on paper, actually leads to amazing changes in the metagame. And this is so good to see, just an absolute resurgence of artifact-based decks, and especially enabled by Talarian Academy. But they're also almost all of them are very, very keenly aware of the impact that Collector Roof has on the format. And you can see in their decks, they can use Talarian Academy as this way to have a bit of an insurance policy when you go, the Oof is out, but this Academy, even though all my rocks are off, this Academy will tap for 8 and I'll play an Ugin, or I'll play, you know, an Ulamog, or whatever it is. You're going to actually be able to just cast something that completely ignores artifact hate. And that's really cool.
Well, what I was saying before is that the Talarian decks do get switched off by Oof. I think it's funny because The Telerion itself, as you say, doesn't necessarily get switched off by Uv. And it does. It creates just a ridiculously unfair amount of mana. You know, it's not like a Sol land where, you know, your opponent plays Ancient Tomb and Eldrazi Temple and gets a turn to Thought Not Seen. You're like, that's not fair. Like, this is on another scale. You know, this can completely alter what, you know, what should happen in Magic, where you can, you know, cast an Ulamog, etc., off one to two lands. But I still think there's a big risk to the Oofs. You know, as I said, like, when you're playing something like Candelabra in your deck, like, that's quite all in. And there's a lot of those artifacts that activate. So you do have to be really careful of the Oof. Or just say, like, that's, you know, like, I might just have to scoop. Because you need a critical mass of artifacts to get that unfair. It can happen, but you need a lot.
Look at the consistent trend between all three of those decks, just as examples. They're all playing Urza, Lord High Artificer, and that fits exactly that model you're saying. You know, okay, yep, I'm going to be vulnerable to Oof, but I have a little insurance policy. You know, if I draw one or two of these different cards, I'll be able to operate outside of it. But you still do get punished by the Oof.
I just, every time I get talking about points, I just think it must be so hard for the points committee, because they've got to factor in, like, recent sample sizes and but it's not just the meta, it's new cards, because there's new cards for both. There's new cards for artifact decks, there's new cards for anti-artifact, and there's new, you know, new cards for Storm. There's this new big green guy. I mean, it's a headache, and I don't envy you guys at all, but it's hard. You just gotta let the meta play out and see, rather than kicking up a stink about, you know, what could be. You just gotta see. I mean, we might find that there's enough anti-artifact hate that these decks in the long run aren't viable, and we might find that there's enough good new artifact cards like Urza, etc., relatively new, that makes the deck viable through a Nullrod or through an Oof.
Yeah, time will tell, right? Like, we'll see how this all pans out. It might be a flash in the pan, and people brew with these things, and then find out, okay, yep, I do get hit by the Oof and other effects, and maybe it's not as competitive as they thought. But I think fundamentally the best sign is that it's happening. You know, people are completely actively going, look, let's this card that, you know, didn't, no one batted an eyelid at 2 points. And now at 1 point, everyone goes, look, I want to actively brew with this. I want to play with this. I'm excited about Highlander. That's such a great sign.
I completely agree. And you know, when the points committee experiment with depointings like this, and I say it's an experiment because a lot of the time you guys put a little clause in saying, clause, you know, this, we'll probably revert it back if it's busted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, most of the time it works so well. Look at Library of Alexandria. It's also a 2 point land that went down to one, saw a bit of flash in the pan play, and now sees much more play than it ever used to, but it's certainly not on the radar for anyone, right? Like,
And you get the opposite effect with, say, Mind Twist, where it goes down to one, bit of a slow burn, no one really plays it, and then suddenly everyone goes, wow, this is really, really good. Everyone plays it. It goes back to two, but then people occasionally play it. That's a good sign. You know, it's no longer just dead on the list. It's people have recognized its power and go, okay, yeah, in my Jund deck, I do have 2 points spare. Or, you know, my Elves ramp deck that splashes black, I do have 2 points spare. I'm going to play this and I'm going to, you know, dominate with it like it was dominating.
When the points committee experiment with points, it means people get to experiment with decks. And I think that's really healthy for the format.
Oh, for sure. And speaking of experimenting, the last card that we'll, you know, chat about, probably have a little bit of a shorter chat about because it is less open to abuse, that's Yawgmoth's Bargain. Now, Yawgmoth's Bargain has probably been on the points list for a very long time, largely paying for the sins of Storm. And it just is those, yeah, the tax of Storm, you know, just to ensure that Storm can't play the critical mass of all these amazing payoff cards. It has been 1 point. Storm does not get as much play as, look, if Black Lotus was super cheap, maybe it might get as much play as it should, because it's one of, if not the, you know, most competitive, fast combo decks that's quite consistent. Now, with Bargain at zero, so immediately what I did was, I went, okay, I just want to, you know, goldfish this deck a bit more. Let's see how we go. And I went, okay, yep, let's chuck in Yawgmoth's Bargain at zero. And as my seventh point, because you're pretty much always Yawgmoth's Will, Breach, and Lotus, those are your 6 points. Then your seventh point, I go, okay, well, I'll play Academy. And Academy has been an ancient tomb in the deck, which the deck is you know, fine with having. It's nice to have an ancient tomb. And then sometimes it taps a four and you're like, yeah, this is great. I just, you know, go off with it. And it's well worth that 1 point in that particular deck. But you could play a number of different things in that slot. You can play Enlightened Tutor, which gets you Lotus, gets you Breach, gets you LED, you know, all of these types of things. So, you know, cost benefits way up. So there's a lot of things you can do with Bargain in a storm setting. Even unpowered Storm, you can use it. But you know, the one thing that I can imagine Bargain being used in is the Academy Rector you know, replenish type combo decks. So unlike Grizzlebrand, which is, look, let's say, I'm not going to say strictly better, but let's say pretty much just puts Bargain to shame in many contexts. the Bargain itself is an enchantment. So you can flash Rector it out and get a Bargain out really, really early.
I never thought about flash Rector.
And, you know, you have a show and tell in the deck, so you can show and tell Bargain. But the problem is you can also show and tell Grizzlebrand. So there are some metrics where Bargain just loses out. If you need two Grizzlebrands, oh, for sure, you know, Bargain's right in there. But generally, you only need one of that effect, and Grizzlebrand trumps it. But the one niche I can see is that, you know, Flash Rector, or, you know, if you end of turn Gifts Ungiven for Unburial Rites, Academy Rector, Cabal Therapy, then you can use that to always get the best enchantment from your deck. Usually that's going to be Omniscience or something, but you can get the Bargain, which, you know, pairs up with Omniscience really, really well as well.
I think it's a fantastic depointing. Really, really good. It's one of those cards no one ever... I mean, I doubt anyone's ever played it in the last couple of years, honestly. It's just such a good depointing. Because it pulls... I mean, again, I keep talking about Vintage, but, you know, it reminds me of, like, the Perfect Storm. And if I can get, like, a deck to be similar to that, you know, then I'm happy playing Storm. And this just gets you one step closer to that. And I think it's certainly a bit too clunky to be worth a point. Like, it, you know, there's so many good aggro decks that the life loss is relevant. There's enchantment removal. There's ways to beat it. If they can get to six mana and play like a 6 mana spell, similar to, I don't know, the equivalent in a mid range, like a prime time or something, like, it's a good chance it's going to win the game. You gotta say they resolved a 6 mana spell. Like, there's a good chance they're going to win the game after that. So yeah, it's just such a good depointing, and I highly doubt it'll be busted. I think if anything, probably something else. If Storm became too good, something else would probably get pointed. Maybe Talarian Academy back up again. But yeah, I think this is going to be one of those ones where you look back and you're like, oh wow, you know, like Protein Hulk and Flash were both 4 points at one, you know, at one stage. That was silly. You know, oh wow, like Yawgmoth was a point. You know, like, yeah, it's a great card, but it's a relic of a time gone by.
So true. So what are you interested about kind of brewing with and playing with in this new metagame, whether it's new cards or whether it's just the way the metagame has changed as a whole? What are you thinking of playing?
Right now, Raj and I are brewing up a junk with Malira, like a Malira pod combo.
Oh, blast from the past. So good. Yeah. I love that combo.
For no reason. It's not like I've made some decision about the meta and I'm like, this is the deck. I've got no idea. That's the truth. I've got no idea. And I think you're kidding yourself if you've got any idea, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I just always let the meta settle and then see what cards... Because there's so much changing in Magic. There's new cards. There's new pointings. It's crazy. It's like trying to, you know, see a chessboard and then suddenly someone changes the rules of chess and then mm-hmm. you've got to quickly figure out what the best move is. I mean, it takes so much analysis. And I'm not even going to sweat it. I'm not even going to try to figure it out. I'll just let you do that for me. Or
let... Like, Beckett, play this deck.
I think, yeah, this pretty is much. Or I'll just let the evidence speak for itself. But in the meantime, it's just a good opportunity to try something fun. So Raj and I are brewing that up. and we'll see if it's any good.
Yeah, yep, that's so good. I'm particularly excited about a couple of the new Coldheim cards that just totally went under the radar in terms of the spoiler season, because they're just, you know, a generic card, you know, but they end up fitting in really, really cool little slots. I'm really, really interested to build Esper enchantments with that card, Furya's Retribution, I think it is. It's a 4-mana enchantment, comes into play with a Sarah Angel and token, and then in the second stage of its saga, so on your next turn, your angel...
Furya's Retribution, I think it is.
That's the one, yeah. So in the second stage of the saga, you can tap angels to destroy creatures with less power than them, which is really sweet. And the final stage is largely irrelevant. Your angels get double strike. But if your token has survived through Brazen Borrowers for that long, you've probably won the game anyway, because it's just, you've got a Sarah Angel. Or the
double strike. I mean, that's 8 damage, right? I mean, that can close a game.
That's a chunker. The most important part is that enchantment stays around until, you know, two turns in the future. Regardless of what the trigger is, I don't care. I want it to stick around so that I can put that trigger on the stack, and then I can, you know, Cryptic Command bounce it to my hand and draw a card, and then replay it and play another angel, and then, you know, that kind of thing. You can blink it with a variety of different strategies. Now, I think this card just is like another tool that Esper Enchantment Control gets. If you look at the, you know, previous, we're point again to the Bluebell Open because it's just one of those recent events. By the time this comes out, that might be older, and the most recent event will be the MTGO tournament. So keep that in mind. It's just based on when we record. But in that event, Michael Billinghurst was playing an Esper control deck. And yeah, as you mentioned before, there's the metagame is a bit more open to decks that aren't Ancestral Recall decks and that aren't blue-green X decks. And Esper control fits exactly that. It's been kind of under the radar for a while because it's been, the shiny power level of the other aspects just take you away from Esper. But cards like, you know, Esper Charm is great. That was fantastic in Standard. Do you remember that card?
Yeah, you can. It's basically instant speed divination or discard or destroy enchantment. Is that it? The 3 modes?
That's it. Yeah, they draw their card for the turn. You make them discard their 2 cards in hand and they're up in their draw phase. It's a cool card. And you just, that has just been a card you can't play because Esper hasn't been competitive due to really being the shadow of a number of other things. And the only way to play Esper is, join the rest of the crowd and also play Akol. And it just, you know, it's no fun. But now, if you look at that kind of list and you merge it with Esper Replenish, which I was playing a couple of years ago, you get to play the card Replenish, where if you've put your enchantments in the graveyard and you cast Replenish, then you're going to have a good day because that saga is going to come back and make you an angel again. All the other enchantments you are using are going to come back, and you can play things like, I'm trying to think of some good cards, Kaya's Oath of Kaya or something like that. Nice removal spell that also fits your enchantment theme that can be, you know, blinked, bounced with Teferi. And then there's enchantments that you can cycle away, like Cast Out and Lay Claim. You know, these remove permanents or gain control of permanents. I'm really eager to put something like Kioribessa Sea God, because you can just have your Academy Rector get Kioribessa Sea God. You make an 8/8 hexproof, you tap all their permanents, you gain control of their thing, and oh, by the way, if that wasn't good enough because they countered your Kioribessa Sea God, or they interacted with it in some way, or you pitched your Kioribessa Sea God to Thirst for Meaning, which is Thirst for Knowledge, but in discard an enchantment.
I was just about to say there's so many good new draw discard spells and old draw discard spells in this format, like Frantic Search and stuff, that you would otherwise not be able to play.
Yes.
But I think graveyard interaction is really, really strong beyond just like a reanimator list or something.
Exactly. You get to, you know, replenish them all back into play, or you get to play, there's an enchantment which I forget the name of, but it's like a 5-mana enchantment, and in your upkeep you return an enchantment from your graveyard to the battlefield. That just sits around and just says, you know, you need to answer this. If you don't answer this, you're going to have a bad day. Oh, you didn't answer it. I'll return my Kyurobesa Sea God. And then the next turn, I'll return my literally anything, Ferge's Retribution. And these all combo with Moat. You know, you play Moat and your only attackers are Angels. You're going to also have a good day. So I'm really excited that just this one card, this little, you know, Serra Angel that is an enchantment that doesn't, you know, the token doesn't go away, the enchantment goes away. That just has just made me really, really excited to build Esper enchantment control combo again. So that's one of the things on my radar.
Yeah. The big card on my radar is Bergy, God of Storytelling.
Ooh,
which is
nice.
Just phenomenal. I think we're probably running short on time here, but it's just a really, really strong Storm card. And especially with Talarion and Yawgmoth going down, we might see a few Storms or even no black Storm, you know, like a red, blue, something closer to the modern list or something, maybe, if there's enough for it. Yeah, I'm really excited to see that card.
Yeah, that looks like a good brew around. I'm also keen to brew around this innocuous uncommon called Clarion Spirit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you do the math on comparing it to Young Pyromancer, if you play your cards right and if you build your deck right, you can get the right number of triggers that parallel a Young Pyromancer. So it can make the same number of tokens that a Young Pyromancer would make. Again, if you build around it appropriately. And those tokens have flying. Now, of course, there's a few more hoops to jump through than Young Pyromancer, but even the fact that we're having a discussion that says maybe Clarion Spirit is in the league to be compared to Young Pyromancer, that's a sign. And I think the card has gone massively under the radar, and it's one that I'm very eager to brew with in any kind of token-making prowess style.
It's an uncommon, and most of the time we look at all the rares and the mythics from a new set and think about what's good, and sometimes uncommons get missed.
Exactly right. So yeah, we've got a lot of sweet things that are coming out of the woodwork, both with the points change and with the new cards. So if you are listening at home and you've got a particular brew that you're thinking about and you don't know whether it's going to be competitive or not, or you don't know whether it'll fit in the new meta, try it out. If not, do some playtesting. If not, post it on the Discord or on the Facebook and just say, hey, I'm thinking about brewing with this particular card or this particular just archetype in general or mechanic in general, and people will help you out. People are really, really good in these social media.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, you need more sample size, you know, you need more input, because it's just so fresh and there's so much info. You just got to get out and give it a crack.
Yeah, that's it. Alrighty, well, we've had a good lot of banter. Whenever you get together for an episode, if Beckett and I are sitting there for recording some kind of content, whether it's, you know, this podcast episode, which Beckett's been our guest star on, or whether it's and the Adelaide Eternal, you know, coverage stuff, we go, oh, do we have enough to chat about here? We always have enough to chat about. we'll talk your ear off. So if you do want to talk about any particular new cards or brews, just hit either of us up. If I don't think you're on Twitter or anything, right, Beckett? But you're on Facebook.
No, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Discord. You can hit me up there. Just Beckett on Discord. So, absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I could chat for another 2 or 3 hours. It's just flown past, hasn't it?
That's it. Always is the way. So yeah, if you do want to get in touch with Beckett, get in touch with him at, on either Facebook or Discord. We'll put some links in the show notes at the end. And obviously, you can just follow the Highlander Cast itself on Twitter. We're at Highlander Cast. So easy way to find us. You can get updated on the various episodes. Likewise, in terms of Patreon, we'll update our Patreon there when there's a new episode out. And if you do want to become a backer of some kind, you can become a 1-point backer, which means anytime an episode comes out, you basically donate $1. And that puts you as a 1-point. You can go any number of points. I think our points capped out at 4. We had a, because that was the highest, but now we technically have five points. You want to be, yeah. If you want to be in the ACOL tier, then you can be in the ACOL tier as a 5-point backer.
I listen to you guys on Spotify as well, so there's that. That's where I get it.
Good call, yeah. So whatever your favorite streaming or media app is, go check us out there. You'll be able to find us somewhere. Just search for 7 Point Highlander or the Highlander Cast. You'll find us. Otherwise, jump on to 7ph.com.au. You can get any information from the committee directly there, as well as the event page for community events results. And you can search 7 Point Highlander on Facebook or on Discord. So check anywhere in the show notes or any of those platforms to get in touch with us. But otherwise, it's been a fun episode. Thanks for joining us, Beckett, and thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks very much, sir. See you guys.
But yeah. Alrighty, and that's a wrap. So we'll just press stop.